In the 1983 finale to the original Star Wars trilogy, Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia find themselves in a bit of a bind as their covert mission to destroy the second Death Star almost gets spoiled by a surprise encounter with stormtroopers on the forest moon of Endor. Our heroes, who are used to being chased, find themselves in hot pursuit as they weave in and around massive trees on a flying speeder bike in a land far, far away. Spoiler alert, after getting separated, reunited, separated again, the good guys win and have a giant party back on that beautiful, lush location. It's a fitting place for the movie and the trilogy to end. The first movie starts out on a desert planet, and we are reintroduced to our heroes in the second film on frost-bitten plains. The final film brings us back to the desert, but we get to conclude our film in a location teeming with life. It looks like the perfect place for a camping trip, but the trees are giant, big enough to fit houses in them. It truly looks like a location that's out of this world. Only it's not. Return of the Jedi was filmed in Northern California in places where the famous giant redwoods grow. Some of its largest trees have a diameter longer than a pickup truck, and the biggest ones eclipse the tallest building in New Hampshire by nearly 100 feet. When I first saw the giant redwoods in person, I couldn't believe my eyes. It was something my imagination couldn't piece together. They were incomprehensible and beyond my expectation in beauty and breadth. There was just something in me that couldn't fully grasp their existence until I took them in with my own eyes. Perhaps that lack of imagination is what most threatens the mysterious, the mystical, and the spiritual these days. We get so used to seeing and living according to what we expect that all of that stuff takes a back seat and slowly finds its way to the trunk before it flies out into the ditch when we hit a bump on the road. Faith becomes fantasy. I don't know about you, but there's been a time or two in my life where I got so used to what I've seen and what I've experienced that I've had to look inside of myself and ask whether I really believed in the supernatural. Sure, it still floated around in my head as true, but there was a part of me that didn't feel like it was true. Maybe there was a part of me that didn't even expect it. And maybe you felt the same at times too. If you had summer plans that got derailed or diminished by this pandemic, if you have loved ones whose health you are concerned about during this time, if you're a healthcare worker whose new normal is breathing through a mask, or even a student or teacher uncertain about what school will look like when you return, I'm really glad that you joined us. Because here's what's at stake. When our normal is filled with uncertainty, discomfort, or even pain, we can lose our sense of purpose and get swallowed up by continual disappointments. Yeah, we might get through this, but we may not be the same on the other end. As this continues to wear on us, it could shift our perspectives and outlooks in a way that poisons our experience of life, even in the best of moments. In the past few weeks, we've talked about some different ways we can experience peace in the moment. God has given us some incredible resources to help us breathe His calm and stability in during the most difficult times. But what happens when the moments turn into seasons? How can we overcome unmet expectations when frustration, uncertainty, and pain have become constants for us? If this continues much longer, if there is a second wave of the virus, how will we be able to experience peace when our normal is continually disrupted? It just so happens that we aren't the only ones who have gone through long seasons of disruption. The Apostle Paul never quite knew what to expect as he traveled throughout the Mediterranean world telling people about Jesus. On some occasions, he'd be warmly received by communities, and he would share in their plenty. Then there were the times that he was run out of cities and endured the ugliest forms of persecution. I imagine, though, that on occasion, Paul simply considered it an occupational hazard. After all, Jesus had warned him in a vision that he would suffer. And he knew, as someone who once persecuted Christians, that the message of Jesus provoked hostile reactions in some. But there were times that Paul suffered when it had nothing to do with the message of Jesus or people's response to it. Scholars, they speculate that he had some health issue, maybe something to do with his eyes. And I imagine in those times, Paul was weighed down by the seemingly meaningless and frustrating setbacks that kept coming his way. Persecution had not come to the church he wrote to in Rome, but it would. And perhaps at the time of his writing, there were just enough rumblings about it to make the Christians uncomfortable, to disrupt their daily lives and throw normal into a little bit of turmoil. In Romans 8, Paul writes to them about challenges like these, giving them some unique perspective in verse 18, and then explaining it with what follows. I want to approach this text by first reading Paul's explanation and then going backwards so we can fully appreciate Paul's conclusion from the ground up. Paul writes, "For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. The creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning, as in the pains of childbirth, right up to the present time. Not only so, we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. But hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what they already have? But if we hope for what we do not yet have, we wait patiently for it. In the same way, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. We do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us through wordless groans. And he who searches our hearts knows the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for God's people in accordance with the will of God." Paul gives these early Christians some surprising news in the midst of their disappointments and frustrations. You're not the only one. It turns out that creation itself, the nature that is all around us, has been subjected to the frustration of decay. Creation is in a constant cycle of birth, growth, and death, just like us. Even some of the oldest organisms, like the redwoods in California, are all watching as their death inevitably comes. And it's because of that that creation is eagerly waiting when God shows the world who his children are, because on that day, it's going to be freed from that cycle. But until that day, creation does something else that might surprise you. It groans. And it's not the only one. Paul says, "We ourselves groan inwardly." And even God's Holy Spirit groans. I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound like the kind of party I want to be invited to. And Paul wasn't interested in being a part of a complaining party either. In another one of his letters, he admonishes his readers, "Do everything without grumbling or arguing so that you may become blameless and pure." When we yield to the temptation to complain, we deny God an opportunity to work through difficult and challenging circumstances. And we plant a seed of bitterness and resentment against him. So how could Paul frame the groaning of creation, humanity, and the Holy Spirit in a positive light? It just so happens that there is a good kind of groaning. And don't miss the word that Paul uses when he talks about the groaning of humanity. It is inward. And when he talks about the groaning of the Spirit, it is silent. And naturally, the groaning of creation follows suit. There is an unexpressed groaning inside of us that recognizes that the world is not the way it's supposed to be and hopes for something more. There is something inside every person that bears the burden of existence and invites us to know that we must have been made for something better than this current world can offer. The dying creation recognizes it and grieves. Our dying bodies exhibit it and lament. The Spirit that lives within the Christian body and experiences its weakening state intimately cries out for God's relief. This is the kind of groaning that the Israelites experienced when they were enslaved in the wilderness. This is the kind of groaning the sick feel during COVID-19. And yes, this is even the kind of groaning that we feel when our eyes strain and to stay attentive for one more Zoom meeting. The experience of decay, frustration, and disappointment all around us and all the time is a sign that we were made for a better reality. And it's right to inwardly groan the effects of this one. I don't know about you, but I find that kind of refreshing. God is not telling us to put on the blinders. He is acknowledging our reality as it is. There's no coat of paint we can put on to cover its problems. But if that's all there is, it's also kind of discouraging. I suppose that's why God places such strong warnings against verbal groanings. When everyone bemoans the state of reality, the chorus of complaining only makes things worse. But isn't it possible that the groaning voices within can create a similar effect? But Paul's groaning wasn't against something bad, it was for something better. In verse 18, he begins by saying, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed for us. The statement is so good it's worth repeating. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed for us. What's to come is so good that Paul can only use an abstract word, glory, that invokes images of perfection, light, and beauty. It's a new reality that doesn't suffer the effects of decay. It's a continual garden that always bears beautiful fruit. It's a new body that doesn't get sick and grow tired. It's everything our imaginations can conjure and so much more. But there's more. The good that can come is so good that it's really not worth putting any kind of potential suffering in this life beside it. One doesn't cancel the other out. The good of the next life is so big and so grand that on a scale you couldn't even measure the suffering that happened in your life if you could set it next to the good that is to come. In preparation for the time that he would spend with Admiral Jim Stockdale, author Jim Collins read the Admiral's book, In Love and War. Admiral Stockdale was the highest-ranking military officer at the prisoner of war camp Hanoi Hilton during the Vietnam War. He was there for over 7 years. As Collins was reading his book, he became depressed over the circumstances he found that the Admiral found himself in. But then he remembered that the Admiral got through it, that he rejoined his family and became a national hero. So he decided to ask him how he refused to let those circumstances beat him down. The Admiral responded by saying that he had absolute faith that he would prevail and turn this into one of the defining moments of his life. Then he invited Collins a little closer. Not only that, Jim, you realize that I'm the lucky one. Collins said, no, I don't. Yes, because I know the answer to how I would do, and you never will. And that prompted Collins to press further about the ones that didn't make it out as easy as he did. The Admiral responded, oh, it's easy. I can tell you who didn't make it out. It was the optimists. Yes, they were the ones who always said, we're going to be out by Christmas. Christmas would come and it would go. And there would be another Christmas. And they died of a broken heart. And then he grabbed Collins by the shoulders and he said, this is what I learned from those years in the prison camp. You must never, ever, ever confuse, on the one hand, the need for absolute unwavering faith that you can prevail with the need for the discipline to begin by confronting the brutal facts, whatever they are. We're not getting out of here by Christmas. I love this story for so many reasons, especially in times like today. But there's a powerful overlap between Paul's words and the Admiral's experience that challenges me to take a step back and reevaluate everything I'm doing. If we set our expectations too low, disappointments will shatter us. and we're not going to have the fuel to get through difficult times. If we are simply looking to return to normal, whatever that is, then maybe the life we're after really doesn't measure well against the suffering we have to go through to get it. But if our hope is in something bigger, mysterious, supernatural, even eternal, then maybe, just maybe, that will give us the fuel we need to, when we lose someone we love, when we miss an opportunity that, or when reality shifts underneath our feet. We can endure if we refuse to hope too small. We can endure if we refuse to hope too small. Friends, we're going to be tempted to just want to go back to the way it was before the pandemic. But there are no promises that it will. There are no promises that this will end tomorrow. There are no promises that a second wave won't come. There are no promises that something even worse won't come. There are no promises. But can you imagine yourself enjoying life now, here, in the midst of your struggle, because you know in your heart that your prize is far better than normal and completely worth the wait? In the dedication to his children's book, The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, C.S. Lewis writes, "My dear Lucy, I wrote this story for you, but when I began it, I had not realized that girls grow quicker than books. As a result, you are already too old for fairy tales, and by the time it is printed and bound for you, you will be older still. But someday, you will be old enough to start reading fairy tales again. You can then take it down from the upper shelf, dust it, and tell me what you think of it. I shall probably be too deaf to hear and too old to understand a word you say, but I shall still be your affectionate godfather, C.S. Lewis." The book is a beautiful fairy tale indeed, but there is a double meaning in Lewis's invitation to his granddaughter, I think. It's an invitation to believe in the fairy tales that are true. The ones where people will cry no more and die no more. The ones where ancient trees will touch the clouds and men and women who once hated each other will swim in pristine lakes and share beautiful tables together. And how many other possibilities are there for us who cling to the one who rose from the dead and gave the world a taste of what they were made for? What kind of possibilities can your imagination only now envision in two-dimensional pictures that you will one day be able to taste, touch, and smell? We can endure. We can experience life. We don't have to fall prey to the sadness even now, no matter what the cost, and no matter how long the wait, because there is something absolutely worth it to look forward to.